Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, British philosopher Jeremy Bentham once wrote that nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. And when you break it down, a lot of what we do in our lives is either about getting some form of reward or avoiding pain. After all, a classic mix of incentives and the threat of punishment is how most kids are brought up, isn't it? Carrot and stick. Anyone knows that a kid will suddenly be much keener to look after the younger sibling or eat that plate of broccoli if there's a treat or even a cash reward available at the end. Although others argue this is encouraging very bad behaviour indeed. That is, good behaviour shouldn't be always in the expectation of a reward. But how do incentives work in the broader economy? Can they actually change the way economies and societies work? Our guest tonight's been exploring the incentives lurking in our world, and it's taken a long, hard look at how they're used, misused, and could be used better. Jason Murphy's an Australian economist. He's the author of a new book called Incentivology. I don't think it is a word, no. The forces that explain tremendous success and tremendous failure. Jason, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure it's not a word, is it?
It's made up 100%.
I think the last person who had a crack at this was John Howard years ago who invented incentivation, didn't he?
Yes, so we are ploughing a venerable row there.
Mm. Yes, well, there have been classic stories of governments and other organisations offering rewards to people who could solve problems for them. I mean, one of the most famous stories, of course, involves figuring out a method to determine longitude. Sailors once used to crash into distant shores all the time because they never knew exactly where they were around the globe. They knew where they were up and down. They knew a latitude. They had an instrument to measure that, but they had no idea where they were going when they were going east to west or west to east. A reward seems to have, well, led to a solution, didn't it? Tell us the story.
Yeah, it absolutely did. So the British Navy was having terrible, terrible trouble with their ships accidentally running into large outcrops of land, and that was all because they couldn't figure out longitude. So the British government put together a prize. They called it the Longitude Prize, and the prize was, to cut to the end of the story, extremely effective. They eventually figured out a solution that saved countless lives and kept a lot of ships on the surface of the ocean where they belonged instead of sinking to the bottom. And basically it worked by inspiring hundreds of people, very bright people, to work really hard on this problem of solving longitude and coming up with the most incredible contraptions that were incredibly convoluted, involving, special grandfather clocks that would keep time on a ship that was pitching around in the ocean.
Yes, of course, it led to the famous John Harrison clock, didn't it? The chronometer, which is the basis of longitude these days. You work out how long it took you to get somewhere, and therefore you can work out how long or how far along you are. Yeah, all right. There are prizes being dangled at the moment for people to do things. I mean, Boeing have $2 million up for grabs for a team that designs a personal flying device.
Yeah, that is absolutely sensational.
How's that going?
It is going amazingly. The designs that have been invented for this prize are really eye-opening. You know, you don't think that we're going to have personal jetpacks and flying devices until you jump on the website and you look at the way teams have responded to this prize with the most incredible innovation, these little sort of tiny flying podiums and little miniature helicopters, all these sort of drone-style devices that are being developed by teams all over the world for this prize that, in context, a couple of million dollars is not actually that large, but it's inspiring this incredible wave of innovation in these devices that frankly look so exciting. I mean, incredibly dangerous still at this stage, I'm sure, but they're so promising and I would really, really like to have a go in one.
Mm. Yes, one of the catches with incentives, though, is that there are often consequences you mightn't have seen coming. This is the famous perverse incentive. Talk us through some of these. Like the paleontologists who ended up causing the destruction of dinosaur bones.
Aha, that is a good one. So there's a famous story about paleontologists paying the local peasants for dinosaur bones, and they were paying the peasants per piece. And in the story, what the peasants do in response to that payment is entirely perverse. When they find a dinosaur bone, they break it up into tiny pieces so that they can collect more of the reward, which is sort of the archetype of the perverse incentive. And there are just dozens of great stories like that.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that's right. Oh, you can't blame the peasants in the circumstance, I guess.
The no, they're doing exactly what the incentive tells them to do, and that's kind of the thing about incentives. If you don't control very carefully what you're asking someone to do, you will get what you pay for, and yet, so you have to be incredibly careful what you pay for.
Tell us the story of the rats in the underground sewers of Hoi An in Vietnam.
Yeah, so that's a really similar thing where the colonial French took over Vietnam, and they were plagued by rats, and the rats at that time were actually carrying plague. And so it was a serious health problem. They really wanted to get the rats out of the city. But in fact, when the French came to Vietnam, they were building sewer tunnels beneath the city. And so in fact, they were making the situation worse because they were providing these breeding grounds for the rats beneath the city. So they provided an incentive, as any right-thinking, modernist public servant would do. They thought to themselves, yes, we'll just pay the locals to remove the rats. And so a price per tail was provided, and the locals responded, as you'd imagine, very powerfully to this incentive and started bringing in rat tails to the French colonial administration. And then what happened was that the French noticed that the number of tails coming in was monstrously large, and the number of rats still roaming around on the street was also monstrously large, and they began to suspect that something was up. And eventually a French bureaucrat stumbled upon a giant rat breeding operation deep in the old town there, and they discovered that if they were paying for tails, they were going to get tails. And the locals were smart enough to figure out that chasing rats down beneath the city was far harder work than just putting a couple of rats in their cage and waiting a little while for the magic of exponential growth to happen and for the rats to breed. In that case, the French got what they paid for.
Yes, well, exactly. You'd think people behaving quite rationally in a way.
Absolutely, they were.
You're an economist, and you're interested in how incentives change economic behaviour. One of the economist's truths is something called Goodhart's Law. What's Goodhart's Law?
This is the idea that if you make something into a target, that it will really cease to operate as a very good target. And it sort of is really well encapsulated by that story from Vietnam, but you can also see it, and it's often put in the context of tests in schools. For example, the NAPLAN test. If the test is designed to study the student's aptitude, but in fact the teacher starts teaching to the test, and so the minute you make the test result into the target, it ceases to be a very good measure of the student's aptitude because all the systems are warped in order to achieve that target, and it stops working as well as it should. And that's the essential nature of Goodhart's Law.
I mean, the same with the rat tails. If the incentive is to produce rat tails, people will reduce rat tails. It won't necessarily reduce the population of rats.
That's right. And so this is an underappreciated problem with using incentives, and that's one of the things that I think is so fascinating about incentives. Mm. We have this, I suppose, superficial understanding that they're very powerful and they're out there, and that's something that the HR department perhaps does to you at work. But what fascinates me about incentives is that they're out there in society, they're proliferating, and that they don't work in so many cases. They produce these side effects that can be incredibly deleterious but are perfectly rational. And if we have a closer look at them, we can really see that pattern repeating over and over again.
I thought there were only two laws that economists paid any attention to. They were the two laws that drive stock markets and drives everything else, and that is greed and fear are the two emotions that operate.
I thought you were going to say supply and demand, but no. Yes, greed and fear too, for sure.
That people are either greedy for something or they fear that they might miss out on something.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And so that's, I think greed and fear is a really well-chosen pair of words, because that that describes how people feel about rewards and punishments, doesn't it? You flee the punishment and you try desperately to get the reward, and that motivates so much of human behaviour.
Let's talk about a category of incentives called the accidental incentive. What's an accidental incentive?
Yeah, so this is one of my favourite parts of the book. The idea, I mean, we all have this understanding of situations like the French have got, where they, you know, they say, bring us a tail and we will give you a payment of, you know, a few cents. But so many of the incentives in the world are not like that. They're not invented by some, you know, central authority that's trying hard to get people to behave in a certain way. A lot of the incentives of the world are completely accidental. They spring up as a side effect of something else. One example that I think is really good is social media. The social media companies are building these networks. Let's say they're building a network to allow us to share photographs with each other. But the accidental incentives built into that create this spiraling changes in the way people behave. And so you see people, for example, getting very close to the cliff edge in order to take the perfect shot for Instagram, and very occasionally stumbling off the cliff edge. And that can, in fact, be traced back to the incentives inherent in the social media network. That is what's driving someone to get, to try to get that perfect shot, is that they want to get more likes on their Instagram. And so for that, you know, it's an example of how a whole incentive system has come up without anyone really to look after it or to tend it, and is having these incredibly surprising effects on society. And, I mean, it's not just Instagram. It's Facebook and Twitter as well.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we've often seen that in marketing campaigns, I suppose, haven't they? I once remember years ago entering a competition that was on the back of a cat food tin, which said that anybody who sends a label, this label in, will receive a share of $100,000. It was in very fine print, this whole competition. I was thinking, well, who would do that? You know, not too many, because you had to soak the label off the tin for a start.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking there's a good chance of, you know, I was a student at the time, there's a good chance of my... When I received the check back for $1, I saw that, yes, in fact... the answer to how many people would bother to go to the huge effort of soaking the label off the tin, the answer is 100,000 people did.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which I suspect, I don't know whether that was a result that was expected by the marketers or not. Incentives can have unexpected consequences, but is there such a thing as a foolproof incentive with no unexpected consequences? Can you plan for every possibility?
I say no. I say that there is no way to make the foolproof incentive, because human beings are just so clever. We are a devious and brilliant species. Maybe not each individual one of us, but if you let an incentive loose on a population of people, they're gonna figure out a way to get the prize without doing the work. It's almost inevitable. And so, I mean, one of the most important things about incentives is that the person that is in charge of them, or if there is one, and my point is that there often isn't, the person that's in charge of them has to be incredibly on their toes and be ready to respond to things like that rat breeding farm in the back streets of colonial Vietnam.
Missing incentives can also have big consequences, can't they? There was a good example in the arrival of the Second Fleet in Australia, which was notorious for the poor condition of the convicts who eventually got off the ship in Port Jackson in 1790.
Yeah, that is just such a brilliant story from Australia's own history of incentives and how important they are. You know, for all the incentives go wrong, you can make things even worse when you fail to include the right incentives. And so the story of the Second Fleet is just a story of death and destruction and misery. The convicts that boarded those ships were extremely likely to die on the journey, and many of them got off the boat in Sydney Cove and died on the shore on the day that they arrived. Like, they were treated appallingly on board the ships. And the reason for that is that the masters of the ships were not given any extra payment or any extra bonus for delivering the convicts to Australia alive. And in fact, they were permitted to sell the provisions that remained unused at the end of the journey. So you can imagine how skinny those convicts were when they got off the boat, because the masters of the ships, their incentives were to feed these people minimally. The earlier in the journey that the convicts died, the less food got used up. And the death rates there are related directly to terrible incentive design and a complete failure to remember to reserve part of the payment for successful delivery of those convicts to Australia.
Do people, this can rapidly descend into a kind of depressing conversation about human behaviour, can't it be? In the sense that we only ever do things because we're incentivised to do them, or we're afraid of the punishment if we don't do them. I mean, do people actually ever do things because it's the right thing to do? I mean, you might have argued in the Second Fleet that Captain Gilbert could have kept the convicts alive and well if he had a bit more humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly it is a sliding scale where some people are incentivized only by reward and punishment, and other people are have morals and will do the right thing regardless of those incentives. But I think you can argue that morality is, for many people, a learned process. When you're young, your parents raise you correctly. They tell you, you know, this is the way to behave. And you learn that. And that's another really interesting thing about incentives, is that their effects last over time. If someone applies an incentive to you a number of times when you're young, that trains you to act in a certain way. And you'll learn that's appropriate and moral behaviour and potentially behave like that for your whole life. And perhaps these ship's captains had parents that could have done a better job you know, teaching them to behave morally and to care for other people.
Yeah, although they did tweak the incentive system for the treatment of convicts after the Second Fleet, didn't they?
They absolutely did. The to the credit of the British establishment, when the news got back to England, and it takes a pretty long time back in 1790 for the news to get back to England of how badly those journeys had gone in the Second Fleet, there was an uproar. There was a massive kerfuffle in all the newspapers, and there was a trial, and this Captain Gilbert that you mentioned was put on trial, and they instituted changes in terms of how the incentives were provided. And the very next bunch of ships that left England full of convicts bound for Australia had a very simple system where the money was provided to the captains when their convicts arrived alive, and the death rate on those ships fell from sort of 40% down to 2 or 3%.
Mm.
Much better, and just such a stark explanation of how powerful incentives can be.
Yeah. As an economist, do you approach all economic behaviour from the idea that people therefore are fundamentally selfish?
I do not. I just think...
Because that seems to be what you're describing, actually.
Yeah. It's not that all behaviour is motivated like that. It's that we are very good at deluding ourselves about the extent of it. I'm not going to claim that everyone is always selfish, but I will claim that we love to believe that we are people of sound heart and strong character who would never, ever do the wrong thing or be tempted off the righteous path. And that's just nonsense. Human beings are driven by incentives, and that is one of the things that I think we need to understand in order to understand how the world works. We need to make sure our incentive design is right, because if we rely on people behaving themselves, we're going to get a bad result. And I think you can see that in the way the world is. For example, if you think about climate change, a carbon price to try to stop people from consuming things that contain a lot of embedded carbon is going to be a much, much better solution than just hoping that everyone is going to suddenly, you know, stop driving, stop flying, stop eating meat. We need to engineer the incentives in the right way to get the right results at that society-wide level. And I hope that is the message of the book.
Yes, okay. I mean, climate change is an interesting one, isn't it? Because you're really, in a sense, asking people to do something which is, you're asking everyone to do something which is detrimental to their way of life right now, on the expectation that things will be better in the future, but some undefined future, and in a sense, some quite undefined benefit too, because the benefit is hard to quantify.
Yeah, absolutely. If you go for a year of eating nothing but lentils, that's quite personally costly, but it would have a tremendous upside for the environment, and you don't necessarily get all that benefit yourself. And so that's why we need leadership in terms of designing these incentive systems for society, so that we get the results that we actually desperately need. And that we're not going to get by just hoping that everyone has this revelation and starts behaving optimally.
But that's a classic example. What sort of incentive would convince someone, say, to give up their motor car or their job in the fossil fuel industry on the deal that maybe in 50 years' time somebody might receive a benefit, but you can't say who and you can't say what benefit?
Well, it's like your cat food example from before. You'd be surprised how small the incentive has to be for lots of people to respond. So when you talk about a carbon price, it doesn't need to be that huge to have an enormous effect. I think if we instituted a carbon price at a very moderate level, we could engineer the kind of outcomes that would substantially mitigate the sort of problems that we look like we're facing in the next 20 years.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose arguing against myself. Sometimes, of course, it does work, doesn't it? I mean, the classic is saving water. Whenever the call goes out to use less water because we're running out, people do. People do use less water, even though, in a sense, it's an inconvenience to what they were doing before. They can't just willy-nilly hose driveways and so on, but people do it. And in fact, you can usually achieve something in the order of 8 to 10% water reductions, not by offering people anything, but just by asking them to do it. So we are capable of altruistic behaviour sometimes, aren't we?
We certainly are. If you give people a target like that, they'll respond well to the target. But also, I mean, water restrictions come with, you know, that's a rule, a water restriction, that you can't water your driveway or you can't water your lawn before 6 p.m. or whatever it is. There'll be a small punishment attached to that, and probably the punishment never actually has to be applied. It's just that threat of punishment that can be very effective. And in fact, that's how you know you've got a good punishment system, when you never actually have to apply the stick. Just the threat of the stick gets the behaviour. And the good thing about a behaviour like watering your front lawn is that your neighbours will be able to see you if you do it. That's something where just the threat of punishment will work quite well to stop people from behaving wrongly.
Oh, okay. Okay. So the punishment is the threat of opprobrium or embarrassment in front of others.
Yeah. Although some of these water restrictions come with actual rules, you know, where you could face a small fine. But certainly social. I mean, social incentives are an enormous part of it. We're a social species, and the incentive of looking good in front of our peers or looking bad in front of our peers is enormous, but equally as powerful as money, probably more so.
Mm. We're talking about incentives with economist Jason Murphy. He's written a book called Incentivology. You can criticise his choice of words, which because incentivology doesn't exist as a word. My texter from Malvern, hello, is saying, Phil, do not use words like incentivise. There's no such word. I agree. We're just using these made-up words because they're behind the title of economist Jason Murphy's book. He's talking about the notion of incentives and the notion of punishments as a way of explaining human behaviour, particularly economic behaviour. Edward's been waiting on there. Hello, Edward.
Hi.
G'day.
How are you? Good.
Yep, getting it loud and clear, Edward. What's your comment or question?
What I was suggesting was there are the sort of incentive where there is a double incentive, if you want, where the person, for instance, in the case of a company, he's made part owner of the company, so that he has a double incentive. One is the bonuses and whatever other normal incentives occurred. And the second one is the fact that he actually, as part owner of the company, is beneficiary as well of the results. So there is a double whammy there. I think if you can design incentives in such a way, I think you probably find that all the negatives disappear, in my opinion. Let's see what the speaker says there, please.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting idea, isn't it? If you make everyone a shareholder, that they'll have a greater incentive to work more efficiently and more productively. Is there evidence for this, Jason?
Absolutely, there is. In a couple of different spheres, one is companies that operate as collectives, where everyone's an owner. That's a really popular idea that is popular across the political spectrum, really, and can really motivate people if they feel like they own the company that they're working at. But we also see a similar sort of thing in terms of executive compensation, where they love to pay them in terms of stock and options, so that the executives are incentivized to, and there's that word again, incentivized. And I'm not going to apologize for it. I like it.
You can stay with it, Jason.
It's a word that should exist, I think, and has to exist.
We've got an ordinary English word. It's called motivate.
Does that really have the same... The thing about incentives, I find that sometimes some people think that they're really just limited to the HR department and they have negative feelings about the HR department, so they feel funny about the word incentivise. But back to his point, that's the problem was that the chief executives of companies were running these companies in a way that delivered short-run benefit to them without considering the long run. And so the compensation design for these CEOs gives them options that pay off only in the future. So it encourages them to consider the long run a little bit more. And that's been a powerful force for making them behave themselves a little bit better.
All right, John, g'day.
Yeah, g'day. How are you going?
Not bad, John.
Just two things on that. When you're talking about earlier about incentive, I've worked in the railways for a long time, both government and private. Back in the old government days, it was the weekend shift would come along and it was job and finish. So it was incentive. We used to get the job done.
Still
get paid for the whole shift, but the job would be done half the time.
I think, John, Garbos still work on job and finish, don't they?
I don't know, to be honest.
I think my local blokes do. I mean, I say blokes because they're all blokes, but I think that you know they've got all the certain number of streets to do, but once they've done the streets, that's it.
Yeah, and that's a good incentive.
Yeah.
If you get the job done, everyone's happy, the job is done.
Yeah.
You might go home an hour early, etc.
Yeah.
And then when we went to private, it was pretty much the same, but then we were self-managed.
Yeah.
And then when the HR people came along, they said, no, you got to work the whole shift. and the incentive went away.
Yeah.
The trains run
HR would hate job and finish, wouldn't they?
They'd really hate it.
They want
you there for the whole 12 hours.
That's it. You've got to be there. You've got to stamp the forms. You've got to fill them out. Yeah.
Well, you've got to be there the whole shift.
Yeah.
They don't even want you going half an hour early, even though you've done everything over and beyond. No, you've got to stay till the end. Whereas the old job and finish, it's a great Australian way that I was brought up with. I've been right in the industry.
I can think of a lot of jobs that would be good with job and finish, like a lot of...
Well, you get the job done. And that's what it's about. It's getting the job done.
Yeah.
You don't shirk away. If the job's not done, you don't go home.
No.
It's as simple as that. You stay there, the job done, go home.
Because otherwise, John, do you agree, there's another law, I forget whose law it is, that work expands to fill the time available. If you say you've got that truck to unload and you've got all day to do it and you can't leave before the end of the day, well, you'll take all day to unload it, won't you?
Correct. And that's why everything runs late.
Yeah. Thanks, John. That's interesting. Yeah. What do you think here, Jason? I mean, he's got a point, hasn't he? That there's a huge self-interest incentive in, say, job and finish. Why don't we see more of that in the workplace anyway?
Well, I tell you what, I used to have a job at a newspaper, and if you finished your story at 3 p.m, they'd give you another one to write.
Exactly.
So you'd finish, and then there'd be more to do, which is sort of what you were just saying. But no, I 100% agree with that guy. I've had jobs where you had to do your time serving. You had to sit in the chair for 8 hours a day, and that was just the worst feeling. You were done for the day, or you could have got your work done more efficiently.
Well, it's work expands to fill the time available, isn't it?
Yeah.
If that's it. Whereas Yeah, well, we don't see so much of it, though. I mean, as I say, I think my garbo's worked to that job. You don't see a lot of it, though, do you?
Your job would be hard to do under that circumstance, wouldn't it? It's hard to squeeze a set amount of radio into a shorter amount of time.
Well, that's true.
That's different sort of a job.
That's different. Every job is different. But in a kind of piecework job where, you know, if you have to do 50 things, and if you can do the 50 things and then go, you'd think you'd get the whole thing done more productively. Although maybe employers see no benefit in it because they've got to pay you anyway. So, you know, they don't save money if you get it done quickly anyway.
Yeah, and then there is the chance that if you let people go early when the job is done, that they'll say that it's done, even though they've done it a bit quicker than they perhaps should have. So there is, I mean, the thing about every incentive is that it's impossible to design one perfectly. And I bet that if you run job and finish, there'll be days where you find that the job is done perhaps a little bit too quickly.
Valerie, hello.
I can see why you would need an incentive to be kind to your fellow man. Mm. I really cannot. All my life, I'm the oldest of 8 kids. I was brought up to be kind and always do a little extra. Do you know there's a fellow called Perfidius who designed Athena, and he was the one who said, do unto the others as you would be done by. And that's my creed of life.
Well, Valerie, yes, I think I would agree with that. I mean, I presume you would as well, Jason, wouldn't you?
Oh, I mean, it's like motherhood and apple pie. Of course we should be nice to each other, but if you look out there, it doesn't always work, does it? I think it's about accepting that humans sometimes need a little nudge in the right direction to behave in the way that we want.
Are you saying something bigger than that? Are you saying that actually we don't really behave unless there is something in it for us?
I'm taking a balanced view where I'm saying, you know, some of the people, some of the time, are going to behave like absolute rotters, and we are going to need incentives to prevent that from happening. And then there are absolute angels out there that will behave perfectly all the time. But if we assume that everyone is perfect, we're going to have a bad time. We're going to get bad results. And I think it's about accepting that and embracing it, and not actually having a sort of a moral perspective on incentives that they're an admission of failure and that they encourage bad behaviour. They're actually encouraging good behaviour. We rely on them enormously, far more than we realise.
Darren, hello.
G'day, how you going?
Not bad.
Yeah, I'm sort of with that lady just called, but I've worked in steel industries and stuff like that, but if your employer doesn't, you know, if he gets up and he's out the wrong side of the bed or something in the morning, he's in a bad mood. Well, that puts, you know, it makes everybody non-productive because you think, well, you know, buggering. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But if you actually, you know, if he's in a good mood, everybody's in a good mood. Everybody's happy. We get more done.
Yep. Well, I think that's right. Exactly. If we just treat it like machine bits at work, then we'll respond, presumably, won't we, Jason?
Absolutely. And, the incentives that humans face are not simple, monetary incentives. We have complex needs, and those have all got to be met. And I think the caller's point's 100% true. A little bit of respect like that goes a very long way.
We're talking about incentives and punishments as drivers of human behaviour, particularly economic behaviour, with economist Jason Murphy. He's written a book called Incentivology, The Forces That Explain Tremendous Success and Spectacular Failure. You, Jason, a while back thought you'd use the power of incentives to force yourself to lose weight. What did you do?
Oh, this is a funny story. So this was a few years ago now. I had had a bit of a long winter on the Tim Tams and got perhaps a little bit more rotund than I needed to be. I sort of knew that I needed to lose weight, but I'd been putting it off and putting it off. And I recognised that, you know, perhaps that was a pattern that was going to keep going unless I got tough on myself. So I set up an incentive system, and spoiler alert, it worked really well. Basically, I pledged to give money to a political party that I did not support if I failed to lose, it was 4 kilos in 4 weeks.
okay.
And so this was the Australian Motoring Enthusiast Party. I don't know if you remember them. They were in the Senate a couple of parliaments ago.
Yes.
They actually turned out to be pretty good in the end. But
Senator Ricky
Ricky Muir.
Ricky Muir. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. fellow with a goatee beard. Mm-hmm.
Like a reasonable fella.
He did turn out to be pretty good. But when they first came on the scene, they were a strange. Strange political party with a focus on, you know, the right to modify cars. I'm not saying I hated them or was deeply opposed to them ideologically or anything. I was just, you know, they weren't a party that I had any interest in supporting. So I pledged to give them a couple of $100 if I failed to lose the weight. So it was a good incentive, good strong incentive, and I just starved myself like crazy for the 4 weeks, and the weight melted off. I was there. You know, 3 weeks and 2 days, I think, the scales ticked over the 4 kilos lost. And, it created a backlash, just like the callers, that you just saw people told me that I was an idiot. They said, you're motivated by hate. If that's the only reason for you to lose weight, then you're going about your life wrong. But to me, that 100% misses the point that, The reason to lose weight is to get healthy, and the incentive system is just a mechanism to control my behaviour in that 4 week period and get the job done.
Well, I suppose everyone's got buttons, and you knew yours, I guess. Yeah. All right. Sometimes you'd think that incentives would always work to modify behaviour in the way you predict, but sometimes, of course, the reverse is true. I mean, the rules don't really seem to apply. For example, if I was selling fridges, I would think a good incentive for me to sell more fridges would be to make them cheaper. I could make them cheaper than my competitor's fridge. That would be an incentive for people to buy my fridge because, after all, they'd save money. However, in the world of luxury goods, this doesn't seem to apply. I mean, if I'm selling a handbag, for example, I could say, look, I've got a perfectly good leather handbag here, which I'm selling for $100. But, of course, a French brand is selling a perfectly good leather handbag for $5,000, and people will buy it. Mm. Now, they're not rewarding. They're punishing themselves, aren't they? I mean, they're having to part with a whole lot of cash just to get the same thing. Why are they doing that?
It's amazing, isn't it? We use the incentive system to run the whole economy. You know, that's what the whole price system is about. It guides people to buy the cheap things and leave the expensive things alone when those expensive things are scarce. You know, when things are scarce, their price goes up, so we don't buy them so much. And it's supposed to work perfectly. But then there's this one exception, which is the luxury goods economy. And in that part of the economy, incentives are completely skew-whiff. And lifting the price on something can make it more desirable. And that's because, we humans are social animals. And we keep an eye on what other people have got. And you can't deny that people are very, very motivated to have, you know, nice things that look good, and that's why you see the streets of Australia crawling with these European cars and LV handbags and all these other sorts of things.
So what's going on there, though?
Well, but basically we're trying to signal. We're trying to signal to other people surreptitiously through our belongings, that we're kind of a big deal. And what that does is it interacts.
But we're paying a big penalty for that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what they call costly signalling. So, you know, you could wear a cheaply printed T-shirt that says on the front of it, I'm a big deal, or I've got a lot of money, you know, I'm an important person. But that's not a costly signal. Anyone could have that T-shirt. So to have a signal that is credible, that is plausible and believable, you need a signal that is hard to fake.
Yeah. Yes, incentives, I don't know. I often think a lot of them are poorly designed. I mean, for example, you might argue that, say, Australia has a problem with the Murray-Darling, and particularly the amount of water that's extracted from it, and we would like to put more water back into the system for the health of the Murray-Darling. So we think we would, so we set up a system of water trading as an incentive for people to be able to sell water back into the system. But, of course, once you create a market for this, people start rorting it, don't they? And, in fact, there have been examples of this.
Yeah, people are taking water that they shouldn't.
And water that doesn't exist.
Yes. That is a really great example of an incentive system that isn't working well. And part of it is because, you know, if you're going to punish people for stealing water, you need to be able to observe that when that happens. If you've got a huge sheep station or a large property out in the Whoops, it's very hard to see that water being, you know, sucked from under the surface of the river and taken away. So observing what is happening out there is absolutely vital to running a punishment system. And with water, that's really hard to observe. And then there's just the plain old-fashioned, taking water that doesn't even exist, which is just absolutely crazy. And I can barely understand how that has been permitted under the system.
Mm. Yeah, we're talking about incentives. Let's get back to some calls. Gabriel, you've been waiting on there. Sorry. Hello.
Hello. Look, I was listening earlier to your talking about incentives.
Mm.
And when my husband was a university student a long time ago, he was a postman in Perth. And within less than a week, the postie said to him, "I don't care how clever you are. I don't care what you do, but did not get back." Oh, he used to turn up to the post office at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, and he delivered all his mail, unlike the person you told us who was telling fibs. And because mail's easy to check, and they said, "We don't want you back until 5, because if you can get there by 1, then they're going to make us get by 1, and that means people will be sat down." What the posties were doing was crisscrossing the road. Whereas what he did, he went up one side and back the other. And stepwise, it was about a quarter. So to please the other posties, he told his mum to be home for lunch. So she had a beautiful lunch for him, and Perth summer was very hot. And then he'd sit down and read a book or do some study for an hour or two and go back for the last 2 hours.
Yeah.
No. And that stage, the postie said to him, "You can come back again next year because you're an intelligent young man."
Yes, well, exactly. Using the system to rort it. On you, Gabriel. Thank you. That's a good story. Derek. Hello. G'day, Derek.
Just a couple of things I want to say. But firstly, your cat food tin label example.
Hmm.
There's no guarantee that 100,000 people wrote in there. It might have been 10 people, and they all got a dollar.
Yeah. Well, that's true. They could have. You mean you're saying I could have been lied to? Yeah, I could have. Yeah.
But I guess listening to this is actually just in the car and listening to this discussion. It's very real to me at the moment. I'm a clinician in a hearing clinic.
Oh yeah.
And ours is an industry with incentives, sales incentives and such, and so it's quite a hot topic. And I guess. Two things. One, at the end of the day, clinicians tend to get the end of the stick as far as the public discussion is concerned, but it's the companies that are trying to drive sales, and the clinicians with the incentives put towards them are sort of stuck in the middle.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that, you know, it's a very real challenge to be in the middle of that and trying to work through your own motives and try and find a middle ground to travel. You've got sort of conflicting obligations. You've got to be loyal or fulfill the terms of your employment, but at the same time you've got to act in an ethical manner towards your clients and then give them trying to get them the best outcomes as well.
Sure, yeah. No, fair enough. Thanks, Derek. Good thoughts. We're talking about incentives and how they affect human behaviour. Theo, g'day.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I just wanted to put my two bobs worth in. I guess I worked in ill effects from the incentives, having been first-hand victim of bullying, threats and harassment whilst in Gladstone on the gasworks. And I feel that with a multinational company that I was working for, towards the end of the job there, each of the staff management would receive 10% bonus on the time that they've been there.
Yep.
And to the detriment of others, I believe that a lot of stuff can be just put in under the carpet and not dealt with appropriately, so that they're not being seen as incompetent in their positions, being from supervisor or manager. And as I found out firsthand, there was a lack of records that were kept, whether I had verbal or written or face-to-face with these managers. I was just basically butting my head up against a brick wall.
Hmm.
But these effects without change can, it's an ill-mannered incentive, and morals can go out the door as far as these people receiving a 10%, because we're all part of a purple group sort of thing, and look after each other. And I think without it sort of being rectified or changed, that people in the future like myself would be have their lives turned around and
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Thanks, Theo. Thanks for telling that story too. I mean, I guess that's true, isn't it, Jason? I mean, the problem with incentive schemes, this is the whole problem with them, isn't it? I mean, trying to devise an incentive scheme that actually does what you're trying to make it do and doesn't do, as you said, as we said at the beginning, something else entirely.
That's right. And the story the guy was just telling seems like an example of Goodhart's Law, where you're trying to encourage these people to have longevity in their positions.
Yeah.
But in some cases, optimising for that is not actually a good idea and just encourages people to stay too long. But I mean, really, the point is that incentives are so powerful, and whether they're well-designed or ill-designed, they're incredibly powerful, and that's why it's so important to focus in on them and design them correctly so that we get what we want.
How can we get rid of plastic pollution in the ocean? I mean, are any of these problems, for example, I mean, so these are some of the big problems we've got today. The warming of the planet, single-use plastics choking the oceans and rivers. How might incentives be used to do something about these things?
Yeah, I was in the sea not that long ago swimming, and the amount of plastic out there was really, really horrifying. And I think that is a huge priority that we need to tackle. And so you really need to think about where can you put an incentive in that system that would encourage people to not loose plastics into the ocean. And it's certainly going to be very difficult to put it on the individual consumer, because you can't easily observe every individual person with their wrapper and give them a reward or punishment for putting the wrapper in the right place. So I think if you're going to have an incentive in this plastics economy, it has to go at the top. There has to be an incentive on the plastic makers to come up with plastics that are more biodegradable, or to have more responsibility for the eventual outcome of where those plastics end up, because that's the single entity upon whom you could place a punishment more easily.
Yeah, because, I mean, in our economic system, if something is cheaper and more efficient, it will be done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Generally, won't it? I mean, not always, but generally. So if a plastic box to put salad in, for example, is cheaper and easier than doing it any other way, then it will be done.
Yeah, and you see that every time. And in fact, we've made some good progress, haven't we, with the plastic bags, you know?
Well, I don't know. I don't know, have we? I mean, we've made some... I don't know whether we've made good progress in that at all. I mean, maybe some places we have. I don't know about globally or generally whether we have.
In Australia, not so long ago, you used to be able to get, grey plastic bags at the checkout at Woolies, and now...
You still can.
Don't you have to pay for them now?
I haven't.
I take my bags along. I'm good.
I know some people do. I just think, that with the growth of things and the more and more things being packaged in plastic, you wonder whether or not the plastic bags at the checkout are the biggest problem, or the packaging of the things that you buy from the checkout are the big problem.
And we need obviously to move the rules and the incentives to other types of plastic, because I mean the diversity of types of plastic is absolutely crazy out there, especially single use bottles for drinks. But I saw an advertisement on the internet just today for packaging that is compostable for packages that are delivered through the mail. Because, you know, people are getting a lot of extra packages these days with online shopping. And that is certainly a major source of plastic pollution. And it's possible now to buy composting ones. And if we... So these products are out there, you know, and we just need to change the incentives around it so that people are encouraged to provide their products in the kind of packaging that is not so harmful.
The takeaway, I guess, is that when we're thinking of changing behaviour using incentives, we've got to think about the design of these things very carefully, because otherwise we'll end up encouraging behaviour which we never intended to encourage at all. Good to talk with you, Jason. It's an interesting book. Jason Murphy is an economist. He's the author of Incentivology, The Forces That Explain Tremendous Success and Spectacular Failure. Terrific to have your time, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Phil. Thank you, and thanks to you, all the texts and callers as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.